If you run into a problem as a practicing musician, you know, instead of just banging your head against the wall and hoping that something works, you know, finding creative ways to sort of get around the wall, you know, that's something that I feel like Julian and Chris Eldridge are just so masterful at. They have all these like really just creative ways of thinking about things and just approaching music and guitar playing that, yeah, it just leads to a much more fulfilled and sustainable and joyful life as a musician. And I'm just grateful to be around that.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman, which I hope inspires you through the personal stories of a fascinating diversity of musical guests. Guitarist Ben Garnett has released a beautiful new album, Kites Keep, and this episode features clips and insights from the project. The record includes collaborations with acoustic music greats familiar to listeners of this podcast, including Daryl Anger and Brittany Haas. Ben's mentor, Chris Eldridge of the Punch Brothers, also appears, and Ben discusses the wisdom he's gained from other influential musicians in his life, among them his cousin, acclaimed rock guitarist Andy Timmons, the brilliant Julian Lage, and bandleader Missy Raines. He also talks about how playing tuba was helpful, and how he immersed himself in a range of musical styles, studying jazz in university before finding his way into Nashville's acoustic bluegrass scene. Like all my episodes, you can watch this on my YouTube channel or listen to the podcast on many podcast platforms, and I've also linked the transcript. It's a joy to bring these inspiring episodes to you every week, and I do all the many jobs of research, production, and publicity. Have a look at the show notes of this episode, where you'll find all the links, including different ways to support this podcast. Hey, Ben, thanks so much for joining me here today.
Thank you so much, Leah. It's a pleasure to be here.
I've been loving discovering your music. I've mostly been listening to your new album, Kites Keep, which we'll be focusing on, but also some of your previous projects. So maybe we'll get a little bit into that because some of these collaborations overlap as well.
Totally. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So the title of the album does not relate to any of the track names.
Right. Or not, at least not directly. Or sort of the loose, poetic meaning I had in mind with Kites Keep was that it was supposed to convey a child's inner world, or kind of a dreamscape of sorts. And like each song on the record is sort of this, a peek into a little vignette of just some kind of realm of imagination, and it kind of takes you through that journey and just different. Yeah, I don't know. I guess, yeah, well, you know, part of the beauty of instrumental music, I think, is that it, the meaning is so non-demonstrative. It's so open and so limitless as far as what it can mean to somebody. And I kind of like to lean into that, I guess. And I like to come up with titles that are kind of, I guess, evocative enough, but don't get in the way of how something could be, you know, could have multiple interpretations, I suppose, to the listener. So
I'm just curious, are you meaning kite as in the bird or the toy?
Oh, kite. The idea was maybe that would be the name of the child, but also it's sort of a symbol of like freedom, or sort of this like limitless, you know, sort of. I just remember being a kid and just like the things I would remember thinking were just so like, in some ways, so much more expansive than the stuff I think about now. and keep just being, you know, you're like kind of your treasury of thoughts, and, you know, just your inner world of things that you're thinking about. And so, yeah, so Kites Keep, like sort of, you know, a child's, inner world, inner kind of a kingdom of imagination, I suppose.
It's beautiful.
Thank you.
When we talked about doing this interview right away, of course, I noticed that Brittany Haas and Daryl Anger were on the album.
Yeah, yeah.
They've both been on this podcast, so people, yeah, you know, even who didn't know about them before will hopefully. And I'll link those episodes. The first track right away, heard Brittany Haas is playing, Look yeah. Again, mm-hmm. Another great title. And it's a wonderful opener. So we're going to play a short clip for people. And of course, the album will be linked. Thank you. But I'm curious about the set list in terms of the album and your recent album tour. When you're doing it live, are you keeping the same order?
Right. Great question. We did an album release show actually in Nashville the day the album came out. It was October 10th. And for that show, we actually did the entire record in order, top to bottom. Mostly because I had like the original band members that recorded the record playing with me, minus Daryl. But it was, yeah, Brittany, Ethan Yojevitz, Chris Eldridge on some additional guitar later in the record. And then my friend Matt Glassmeyer playing some piano on one song. So for that show, we did the whole record in order. But then for the tours, I think we always start with Look Again, because I feel like that's just kind of a nice way to get the band warmed up. And it's just, the energy's good on that one. It kind of gets everyone engaged in a nice way. But then from there, we kind of go, you know, we tackle some songs that happen later in the record. We do some cover songs. And so it's a little bit more, mix-matched and adding different things in for the live shows. But yeah, it's interesting what translates, you know, as far as a programming for a record versus programming for a live show. I think those things are different in a way.
Yeah, and sometimes I think performers will tweak the order in the moment according to the energy of the audience.
Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah. So the second track, Tell Me About You, with Daryl Anger, yeah. You've been in Nashville for a while. Had you met him early on, or?
A couple of years ago, maybe like 3 or 4 years ago, in Nashville, there's a lot of these, parties that kind of center around jamming, you know, playing together, or just, you know, people invite all their friends and then you meet people that way. So I probably met him at one of those gatherings at some point. I'd always kind of, you know, just dreamed about playing with him because he's been a hero of mine for so long. Yeah, just, you know, I had this tune, or I had a couple tunes actually, and I just thought he'd be just the perfect fit for that. And so reached out to him and he agreed to play on the album, which I'm very grateful for. And yeah, on Tell Me About You specifically, we kind of, you know, I brought in a lot of the core, just, you know, arrangement and ideas and melodies and things, but he really had a hand in, I suppose, like the interpretive quality of that piece, and really bringing his voice and kind of just adding life to it, you know, which he so, you know, famously and over the many, many years he's been making music, that's just kind of what he does the best, in my opinion.
What's he like to work with?
Oh, just the best. I mean, it's so great. And he's very he's so good at kind of working with the material that you've brought to the table, but he's kind of, he has this way of suggesting. It was almost like it was a mentoring session in a lot of ways, of him sort of guiding, you know, the composition in a way. And he also was able to make things, at least the parts I was wanting him to play, I feel like he kind of helped me figure out how to like break them in a certain way, so the music kind of had more of this casual, maybe more interpretive quality to it, where it wasn't so rigid, you know. It wasn't like you have to play this exact thing here and then do this here, and you know, he kind of was able to bring in he's able to just like open it up in this really beautiful way. I mean, it's hard to talk about but he does it, and it's just so great.
Beautiful album cover. Emilio Mesa, did he take the photo?
Yeah. That was a photo from a long time ago, actually. We did a photo shoot, actually, for my first record back in 2020. I think it was like right before COVID started happening. And Just kind of a fun. Emilio is an old friend of mine. So I went to school in Denton, Texas, at the University of North Texas, and Emilio was actually like a peer, or like a fellow jazz student there. And we just stayed in touch over the years, and he got really into kind of, you know, photography, like experimental photography. And I knew I kind of wanted like a more just like, I don't know, experimental, cool photo shoot for my first record. And so we did that. And I think in that photo was like, it was shot on expired Kodak film. So it has this kind of like, I'm not sure exactly what that does to the film, actually, but it creates kind of this like kind of painterly, you know, kind of washed feel to it. And it's just great. Yeah. So you know, in looking for an album cover for this album, I just was looking through some old photo shoots and I was like, wow, that one's really, it's pretty strong as far as like a shape and just, you know.
And this dreamscape feel.
And the dreamscape feel. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
So you played tuba in school.
I did, yeah.
So you're your first instrument?
Piano was my first instrument, actually. I started playing, I mean, it was very casual, not, you know, not very serious. But then, yeah, tuba came to the picture, yeah, when I was 12. You know, like, I think it's, like, at least in Texas, like, sixth grade was the time when all the grade school kids could, like, join the concert band. And yeah, started playing tuba in the concert band and stuck with it for, you know, all the way to my senior year of high school, and was all, you know, was almost thinking about doing it for college. But then I had, you know, I was, yeah, really into the tuba, and then I was taking also like kind of serious classical piano lessons, and then also guitar was a very strong part of my life, but ultimately the guitar won over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So before we get into your life as a guitarist, I'm
sure.
Curious, do you think playing at the bottom of the band, playing the bass line, gave you something?
Yeah, what a great question. I absolutely think so. In playing at the bottom of the band, but also just playing a part of a really large ensemble, I think gave me, yeah, it's interesting to think about. I mean, I definitely think it gave me a certain like orchestral sensibility and just understanding how parts work together. Especially as a guitar player, you know, because I think guitar is such a community that, you know, yeah, it centers around the guitar itself, and you know, often the guitar is playing in a smaller ensemble, just like historically or whatever. Thinking of myself as part of like a larger like wind ensemble or like a symphony orchestra or something, playing the tuba, I think it gave me a realization of just how powerful that can be, of how like parts can work together, and yeah, the beauty of that. So I definitely think it probably informs the way I write music and arrange music nowadays, especially now being in the string band world primarily. It's like, I feel like a lot of string band music kind of has that orchestral quality to it.
So your cousin, Andy Timmons.
Yeah.
You want to tell us about him?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Andy, he is like, yeah, in my opinion, like one of the best living rock guitar players like of all time. Just incredible. And he's my cousin. Yeah. So when I started playing guitar, actually right around the same time I started playing tuba, when I was 12 years old or so, my dad told me that I had this cousin who's a fairly well-known rock guitar player, and his record Resolution had just come out, and it's a trio record. Largely it's just like electric guitar, bass, and drums. As soon as I heard that album, that like kind of changed my life. You know, it was like, that's, you know, whatever that is, like I want to be able to do that on some level. So you know, Andy's coming from this like instrumental rock guitar, you know, like Joe Satriani, Steve Vai, Eric Johnson, this kind of this crew of 80s, 90s guitar players that were really big and like just this instrumental rock guitar scene. And, but Andy's thing was always, it was very song oriented, and those other guys actually very song oriented music. And I love that music too. But, I think what Andy's music kind of instilled in me, at least like probably subliminally at that age, was just how powerful, or just how much power you can get from just delivering a song, you know, even if it's in like kind of an instrumental guitar format, you know, just how much just how powerful that can be, you know. And it's not necessarily about shredding or playing really fast or doing crazy guitar pyrotechnics, you know. It's really about just, can you just say something? And that was just a really important album for me to hear, I think, at that time, a really formative record. And then furthermore too, that record is kind of a rare, as far as orchestration, kind of a rare thing in his catalog, where it was just there's no overdubs on that album. It was just one guitar track, one bass track, and one drum track, you know, because usually these like rock guitar albums have like a lot of like keyboards or synths, or I don't know, it's like a lot of different things happening. But there was a certain like austerity to that record. It was very, you know, kind of, there's a lot of space for it being as high energy as it needs to be for being a rock record. And yeah, so I think that also had an influence as well, especially now that I'm playing in a more trio-oriented format with fiddle, guitar, and bass.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking, I've interviewed Pat Irwin a couple times, who composes for cartoons and also has this rock guitar career, and he toured with the B-52s for 18 years. But recently he's playing in a trio, exactly that format. And in our last interview, he was saying, yeah, you're so exposed. It's like... fun, but
oh man, the trio. Yeah, like, you know, we just did a tour 2 weeks ago, or my album release tour, and learned so much about just, I don't know, that ensemble. It's tricky, you know. I don't want to say that it's easy to sound bad, because I don't try to like buy into like things that are good and things are bad, you know. It's all just different, or it's what you're going for. It's not necessarily good or bad, but it's easy for, yeah, especially like an acoustic trio like that, you know, unless everyone is just like hive mind, totally together, playing with pounds and pounds of intention, you know, so much, you have to play with so much intention for things just to even come across as coherent, I think. There's a lot to learn about just being musical and being, yeah, intentional, and yeah, there's nowhere to hide in a trio, for sure.
So Ben, before we leave Andy Timmons, so he
played with
No, don't apologize. I just so he played with Danger Danger, Olivia Newton-John, some big names people might have heard of.
Yep.
So you did have a relationship with him and like saw his huge collection of over 100 guitars.
Yeah. It was amazing. Yeah. No, I know. He just like took me upstairs to his studio, and yeah, hundreds of guitars, tons of vintage amps, and yeah, I guess. Yeah, from a young age, I was able to see just like, I don't want to use the word guitar god, because I think that maybe is not, I don't know, because he's human like the rest of us. But yeah, I definitely got to like witness just like how like the great guitar players, I don't know, how they work and what their home life is like, and you know, all that stuff. So it was cool. It was really, really special.
But at a young age, it also gave you a glimpse of the life of a touring musician?
Absolutely. Yes, exactly. And it like validated that in a really powerful way too, because it was like, oh yeah, like, you know, this is like a totally, I don't come from a musical, or at least my like immediate family is not a musical family. And so I think for them, it kind of like gave them this window into like this other way of living life, I guess. And yeah, it was cool. Really cool.
I wanted to ask you about Julian Lage, because he was an early mentor. And, you know, it's one of these names I kind of heard about, but then I looked him up more. Very interesting, like child prodigy. And he's actually has done like duo albums with Chris Eldridge, your other like main mentor.
Definitely.
So how did you meet Julian, and what was that mentorship relationship like?
Yeah. So I met Julian at, there's this camp in Savannah, Georgia, called the Acoustic Music Seminar, put on by a great mandolin player named Mike Marshall. And I don't think it's happening anymore, unfortunately, but there was a string of years, maybe like 6 or 7 years, where it was going on every single year. And and Julian was a teacher at this camp, and I was able to go, I think it was 2017. And yeah, it was crazy, actually. Mike Marshall was running it. Julian was a teacher. Brian Sutton was also teaching that year. Aoife O'Donovan. And then I think that was like the main kind of core faculty, and then like Edgar Meyer came in for a masterclass that week. Sarah Jarosz, I'm forgetting some of the other musicians, but it's linked with the Savannah Music Festival. So often, like musicians that are playing at the Savannah Music Festival that know about the camp will like come and also do something with the camp. So it was amazing, and like that was my first time meeting Julian. And I got to work with him. Part of the format of the camp was that we, all the participants had to bring in two songs or, you know, two pieces. And every day there'd be two main sessions where, I guess Mike Marshall and whoever would like kind of arrange the students in different groups and would select a song of the songs that all the students brought to workshop for like that part of the day. And then one of the instructors would be sort of hovering or, you know, kind of like essentially producing the session. And luckily was able to do most of those sessions that I was playing in. Julian was the mentor, the producer of that session. And just like, you know, really formative lessons and just things that he talked about. And you know, he's for his I don't know, kind of joyful, and he kind of has this like angelic presence in a way, you know, he kind of just emits this like really beautiful, joyful energy. You know, despite all that, he can be very direct and intense, you know, like can really tell you what he's thinking about something. And it was great. It was like kind of exactly that I needed to hear as a 22-year-old musician. And yeah, most of it revolved around just, you know, listening and how to play with your fellow musicians and not play at them. And you know, you're kind of, yeah, you're just part of the bigger picture. You know, it's not all about you. Not only is it not all about you, but how do you actually enhance the musicians playing with you? Which is a huge one, and you know, I'm still thinking about that and working on that. But he's, yeah, that was definitely probably one of the bigger lessons I feel like he imparted on me. And it was just a week, you know, it was just 7 days of that camp. And anyway, so that's where I met Julian, and I also met Chris Eldridge at that camp as well, because him and Julian played a set at the Savannah Music Festival that year.
I was just thinking what you were just saying. I'm in the classical world, and right, that can be so true, because people spend hours locked up in practice rooms by themselves.
Yep.
Even if they play, have some ensemble experience, they don't sometimes really get it. And
exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a muscle that you can only really work unless you're playing with other people. You know, it's, you can spend as much time in the practice room as you want, but like the real thing, or the real just magic, you know, I think it comes from that relationship, or those relationships that you have with other people in the moment.
Yeah. For me, I like to think of widening my focus.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. You're kind of, you know, it's like tapping your stomach and rubbing your head or something, you know, to be able to like really, to have what you're doing be such a, in some ways, you don't want to be really thinking about what you're doing, because you want all of your attention to be, you know, a part of the room or a part of the other musicians that are doing things. And you want to be able to have that kind of instantaneous reactive quality to your musicianship of, you know, can you be flexible and available enough to, you know, just be present and be, you know, an adaptable person to the constantly changing environment around you.
So Chris Eldridge.
Yes.
You met him in Savannah as well. He's been such an important musician in your life. And actually, your first album he produced.
Yep.
And with this release of Kite's Keep, I saw the little interview with him, and he was saying how you've kind of come into your own, you know, because you were the session leader. I mean, you did everything for this album.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He produced my first record, and that was I guess we started, you know, meeting and doing like pre-production in 2019, actually. And then we recorded towards the end of 2019, early 2020, and then COVID happened. I think, you know, the album already was kind of ambitious, at least from my end, because it was, I didn't necessarily have like a set repertoire that I was trying to record, unlike Kite's Keep, where I kind of had a vision for that repertoire. Mm-hmm. my first record, Imitation Fields, it was much more like, you know, what's I kind of just showed him like everything I had written until that point that I thought was like coherent enough to show him, and he was able to kind of select the ones that he felt like, I don't know, that sounded the most like me, I guess, or that, you know, he felt like were most representative of my compositional voice, I guess. And so it was yeah, in a lot of ways just a lot more open of a project. And then there's also this whole element of like electronic manipulation and electronic post-production mm-hmm. that we were working with within a string band context. And just kind of because that hadn't, I mean, there are some examples of that over the years, but the particular aesthetic that we were both looking for hadn't necessarily been created yet. So we were, it was just a lot of experimenting. And then I think also COVID played into it of just, you know, we had all this time now.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah. So the process of like after we recorded just took way longer than usual, I would say. It was almost just my first record. You know, I was just learning about how to edit and how to, you know, really say the things that I wanted to say with the music. And it was at times frustrating, but at most of the time just a beautiful mentorship and learning experience to work with him on that.
So he's featured on the two last tracks of Kite's Keep. I have to ask about the title, Post Office Prodigies.
Yeah. I don't know where I found that, actually. So that piece, actually, I'll be honest, I wrote it sort of as a joke at first. Right? I just wanted to see if I could like write something just in a more like pop music temperament, I guess. So I probably wrote like 20 or so melodies. I kind of had that form. It was like E major, AABA, kind of, you know, in the way that Bill Frisell kind of writes tunes like that at times. You know, like he'll like take a very, or he'll write something that is very common or just plain template, and then he uses that as a vehicle to improvise. And it's very compelling. I think it's a very cool aesthetic. And so I was sort of thinking about that and wanting to work with that. But yeah, this melody on Post Office Prodigies, you know, that was just like one of the 20 little pieces that I had written. I was like, I actually really like this. And then the title came afterwards, and I don't know. I mean, so P.O.P., that's like, you know, pop. Like
that, oh, was okay.
That was the, at least like part of the inspiration, I suppose. But then, yeah, Post Office Prodigies, you know, kind of sounds like a bad 90s band, or, you know, made up some kind of made up band or something. But then also, it kind of has like a beautiful, poetic thing, I suppose, of like, just extraordinary people in ordinary places, I guess. You know, just the fact that anyone can be a prodigy in their own way.
Actually, speaking of prodigies, when we were talking about Julian Lage, I meant to ask
you. Right.
So I'd read he developed focal dystonia and then got over it.
Yeah, right.
When you knew him, was he suffering with that? Or
no, I don't think as much as he was before. I actually don't know when that was, or like when the main time of that was for him. I feel like it was like during his college, or like closer to his college, because he went to Berklee College of Music, I believe. And I think it might have been more around then. But I know, I mean, he's, yeah, just not only a master of music and improvisation and guitar and whatever, but like a master of like movement. And, you know, he studies this like modality of movement education called the Alexander Technique, and, you know, he's just so deep on like how we can really work with our bodies, or, you know, like the natural design of our bodies to get the most like efficient response or the most efficient response and performance out of ourselves and in our instruments. And we got into a little bit of that at Savannah, but the Savannah thing was mostly music oriented, I would say. But I know he's thought a lot about that, and it's something that I think, because he had his injury, kind of like revolutionized his whole technique to, you know, around this kind of thinking about movement and being, being efficient and really thinking about how our bodies actually want to move rather than how we think they want to move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I've had quite a few people on the podcast talk about this stuff. And actually, when your episode's released, I will have already put out my episode with Jennifer Johnson and body mapping, which...
Oh, cool. Yeah, yeah.
You know, it sort of came out of Alexander Technique, but I've done both and I think it's better. It's like okay. It's really, really great. So
cool. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's something I don't know a ton about, but I know. Body mapping.
So we were talking a little bit about Chris Eldridge. I'd love to know what you've learned from him in terms of composing and as a guitarist. And some people may not know who he is. Maybe you could just speak to that a little bit.
Sure. Yeah, Chris Eldridge, otherwise known as Critter, or Critter's his nickname. And Critter. He's just one of the greatest musicians and guitar players alive. He grew up sort of around like bluegrass royalty, in a way. Like his dad, Ben Eldridge, was the banjo player in this really influential bluegrass band called The Seldom Scene. And his mom, actually, too, Diana, is a really amazing banjo player. So he's the son of two banjo players. Yeah, I think he also, similar to me, actually, started with electric guitar and was really... this one guitar player named Eric Johnson, who's actually very close friends with Andy. They're both, these, like, Texas, instrumental rock guitar powerhouse players, And... So Eric Johnson was like Critter's first main guitar hero, and so it's cool because I feel like he and I kind of share that initial influence on the guitar. And then I think bluegrass, his mom gave him a copy of Tony Rice's Acoustics album, and I think that kind of changed his world. And yeah, I think he just got deeper and deeper into acoustic guitar and bluegrass, and wound up going to Oberlin College of Music. And then he joined a band called the Infamous String Dusters. That was his first group. And then eventually joined the band Punch Brothers with Chris Thiele. And basically joining Punch Brothers, he's just been on the front lines of acoustic music and just, what's possible and really pushing the boundaries in all these beautiful ways while also being very, rooted in bluegrass and traditional music and just being this... I don't know. He's able to transmit he's such a walking encyclopedia of traditional music. It's awesome. The way I came to know about him was actually through Julian, because I discovered there was a record that they put out, I think it was 2012, an album called Avalon. And I think that was their first like full-length album as a guitar duo. Chris Eldridge and Julian Lage. And that album totally, in a similar way that the album I talked about before, Resolution, kind of changed my life, Avalon totally changed my life. And,
Hi, just a really quick break from the episode. I wanted to let you know about some other episodes. I've linked directly to this one in the show notes, which I think may interest you, with Daryl Anger, Brittany Haas, Mark Van Vught, Talia Halom, and Alyssa Rose. In the show notes, you'll also find a link to sign up for my newsletter, where you'll get exclusive information about upcoming guests, a link for my Ko-fi page to support this project directly, where you can buy me one coffee or every month, and my podcast merchandise store with a design commissioned from artist Steffi Kelly. You can also review this podcast, share it with your friends, and follow on your podcast app, YouTube, and social media. All this helps spread the word. Thanks. Now, back to my conversation with Ben.
Because at that time, I was going to the University of North Texas. I was studying jazz guitar. I was pretty deep into just, you know, improvising and modern jazz and just like learning all this vocabulary stuff for the music. And the way that Avalon, you know, the way that Julian kind of brought that in to the music on Avalon with Critter's, you know, traditional bluegrass background, but then also like Julian's pretty just knowledgeable and heavy like traditional jazz background. There's a lot of like early jazz influence in Julian's playing. It was just this like incredible amalgamation of just things I just never thought were possible to like put together, you know. And they did it, and it was just like, what is this? This is so cool. It, with it being in such a, I don't know, like it's just two guitars, you know. The fact that they can communicate so much and, you know, do so many things just within that really kind of basic format was just incredible to me, and still is. And so, yeah, and then moved to Nashville, I met Critter at the Savannah Music, or the Acoustic Music Seminar, and then when I moved to Nashville, became closer friends with him, and now he's like one of my closest friends, I would say, kind of like an older brother at this point.
Yeah. You have two bass players on this Kites Keep, mm-hmm. who were previously featured on this podcast because of different projects. So it's kind of cool for me. Like, I haven't met any of you in person, but I feel like I'm knowing everyone's friends. So yeah, Paul Cowart's in Hocktail with Brittany.
Yep.
And Ethan, like, I know he played with Leif Karlstrom and maybe some other people. Like, I recognize mm-hmm. these names, and this, and, you know, both great bass players.
Right, right. Oh, man. Two of the best, in my opinion. Yeah. Yeah, so Ethan is actually, you know, he plays bass on most of this record. He plays bass on, I think, 8 of the tracks. And then Paul came in just for one day and played on 2 songs. But unfortunately, the first song that he played on, I just couldn't find a place for it in the sequencing. So I cut it sort of at the last minute. So Paul just plays on 1 song. But that was a really special song, actually. It's track 5, The Clockmaker, and that one actually features both Daryl and Brittany and Paul. And that was a really fun one to record.
Do you want to say anything more about that track?
Yeah. that was a fun one to write because I kind of had this, I guess kind of like Irish-y melody. I had that for a long time. But it was, I guess trying to figure out just different ways to present it. You know, I was listening a lot to, there's a really great record that Edgar Meyer did with Mike Marshall and Bela Fleck called Uncommon Ritual, where there's a lot of, there's a lot of, it feels like they're presenting like traditional melodies or, you know, pretty like basic melodies, but in these very interesting ways, you know, they're arranging them, but they're also like, it's so much about the context in which they're playing the melody, if that makes any sense, like just the orchestration around the melody. So that was probably like percolating in the back of my mind when I was writing The Clockmaker. So I feel like that piece is interesting because it relies a lot. There's definitely a pretty heavy-handed like textural element to the piece, but there's also sort of this. Independence of parts, you know, like just for instance, like the bass kind of starts off in like a 3/4 time figure, dun 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 dun, 1 2 3 1 2, and then the melody's in 4/4, dun 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 dun, and just having that independence, but it also kind of works together. It sort of reminded me of like clocks, you know, ticking at different times, but they're all on the same wall. They're all like connected somehow because it's all coming from the mind of this clockmaker or something. Yeah. and so the piece just kind of like develops from there and takes those various motifs and things and yeah. Thank you.
So Ben, talking about like, you know, creative prompts and inspiration, I was reading that you really love like art house film, and there's a cinema in Nashville, the Belcourt, that you like to go to.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Do you have favorite films or something you've seen recently?
Oh boy, so many favorite films. Unfortunately, I've not been able to see a lot of films lately just because I've been so focused on this album release tour that we did a couple weeks ago and just putting out the record in general. I just haven't been able to go down there. But there was a while where I was going to the Belcourt maybe like 3 times a week.
Wow.
A couple times a week. And it was just, I don't know, like I get a lot of inspiration from like long form art, you know, especially this day and age where everything just feels so like chopped up, and you get 30 seconds of this, you get 30 seconds of that. So yeah, I don't know, like, or thinking about films as albums or something, or, you know, thinking about at least like the trajectory of how a film takes you from point A to point B, and how a song can do that, or how an album can do that, or that's mostly the inspiration for me, at least. And then also, yeah, like character development, I think, is really interesting. And if you apply that to, you know, just like motivic material within music, I think that can be kind of an interesting parallel. And then also, I sort of think of myself in a way when I'm making records or writing music, I think of myself in a way as like a film director. Like I, you know, I'm hiring these characters, Daryl, Brittany, Paul, Ethan, you know, these actors, I guess, and they're just so masterful, and they're able to kind of inhabit the perspective of the characters that I'm asking them to play. So I guess I'm watching a lot of movies, like thinking about, like, you know, what was the director thinking about when they chose this scene, or how they wanted the actor to be a certain way, or, you know, why does that happen before that, or, you know, just, yeah, all these different things about what goes inside a movie or any work of art, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, just thinking back to when I, you know, I'm in my late 50s, so I was a young person before, well before the internet. And, you know, there was just so many old cinemas, and you could just see, it was just, yeah, it was such a easy thing to do. And when I was a student, I can't remember if they were discounted, but I was in Montreal at McGill, and there was just like so many of these cinemas, and we were going quite a lot, more honestly, more than to concerts, like going to see all these old movies and new, just so great. I kind of miss that feeling.
Yeah. It almost seems like movies are not, I don't know. They're just like not as, they don't have as much of a hold on like the public consciousness or something anymore. I mean, I think people still watch movies, but it's a
different context, right?
It's different context. Yeah. You know, we're much more used to kind of these episodic things, you know, just shorter, dealing with things in shorter doses, I think.
And at home alone.
At home alone. Instead of going to like a theater and like experience that with everybody. But it's fun to do that with, to be in a theater with other people and see how everyone's kind of feeling the same thing. You're kind of like, you know, it's like a collective dream or something. You're all like going to the same place together, which is cool.
So your jazz influence and jazz language definitely comes through in your records, but I was kind of curious, so you went from like rock to jazz at University of North Texas, and then getting into the bluegrass, and we'll get into some of your traditional bluegrass projects as well, but like how did that happen?
Yeah, well, so it was mostly through this one album, Avalon.
Okay.
Because before I had heard that record, you know, I was like all electric guitar, kind of rock, jazz. You know, that was my main awareness and template that I was working from as a guitar player. And then as soon as I heard Avalon, you know, and just found out who Critter was, found out who Punch Brothers was. You know, and then I discovered, like, I think David Grisman was next, Bela, Jerry Douglas, Edgar Meyer, Mike Marshall. And then I wound up going to this seminar, the acoustic music seminar in Savannah, and then I just meeting everybody and then hearing what they were listening to, and and then moving to Nashville, and then I got a job with great bass player Missy Raines about a week after I moved to Nashville.
Okay.
And And then since touring with her, you know, I've just gotten to like meet a lot of people in the bluegrass community. And so, yeah, just kind of like, yeah, very, very stepping stone, but I don't believe too much in like destiny or fate or anything like that, but it definitely felt like I maybe like walked into something that was waiting for me with that.
So Missy Raines, really a legend. Do you want to talk to her about her a little bit?
Absolutely. Yeah. So yeah, Missy Raines, she, this like incredible, bass player, songwriter, just has been in a part of the bluegrass community for a long time. And yeah, has been my band leader, my boss for the last eight years. I joined her band in September 2017. About like a week after I moved to Nashville. The ensembles in which I've played with her have changed over the years. Like when I first joined her band, it was a trio. It was like a fiddle, bass, guitar trio, which may or may not have had an influence on the current trio that I now have. But because at that time she had this project called Missy Raines and the New Hip, which was a more like electric, you know, there's electric guitar kind of incorporated with that. There was drums, kind of like a rock fusion jazz bluegrass crossover group. Yeah, and then I think she just over the years just wanted to go back to a more traditional bluegrass, go in a more traditional direction, just more akin to her roots as a musician. And she was, and I just feel really grateful that she still wanted me around for that. Because honestly, you know, at that point, I hadn't had really any experience playing guitar in like a traditional five-piece bluegrass band. It's so fun. You know, in a way, it's a very, I don't want to say it's a narrow role, because within you know, that role of bluegrass guitar, it's so expansive. But, you know, in some ways, you know, I'm just playing like rhythm guitar, like 90% of the time. But you know, just studying like Tony Rice and Clarence White and Doc Watson and, you know, all the great like acoustic guitar, bluegrass flat pickers, you know, and how they play rhythm guitar, you know, in that kind of ensemble. It's just deeply, yeah, inspiring and definitely informs the way that I approach my own music. And, you know, because I think the acoustic guitar specifically, is so powerful at that kind of thing of, you know, it's kind of building a stage, or it's creating a world that all these other instruments in the band can kind of inhabit. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's a great, great privilege and great joy to play with Missy.
And it's uncommon for a woman to be band leader in the bluegrass world.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah,
or
yeah.
Really in any world.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and she's such a trailblazer, you know? Like, she did it, at all costs. You know, and she, you know, because she was a part of Claire Lynch's band back in the day. And I think it was safe to say that that was probably, like, a model for her, you know, to, like, as far as, like, a female band leader. And, you know, but there's also like Lynn Morris doing her own thing. Like, you know, there was like a few like female bluegrass band leaders at the time. And I think those were definitely big inspirations for her to go out and trailblaze and do her own thing, which she's done so beautifully. And yeah, I'm just lucky to be a part of it.
So in terms of modeling for you, what a good band leader is now that you have your own band.
Right, right. Oh man, so much. You know, she's such a pro. She has like all of her bases covered. No pun intended, I guess. What to bring for a merch table? How to like box up all your stuff so it doesn't. I mean, these are like non-musical things, but you know, in some ways, like
part of it.
Yeah, part of it. Yeah, but just like, yeah, like how to travel like efficiently, and you know, how to just, yeah, have the easiest time on the road that you can. You know, and she's been such a. Just so steadfastly, just like a pro at that, you know. Yeah, you know, and then musically too, you know, she's I think because of her position as a bass player, she's sort of I think in a lot of ways like relies on the voices and the abilities of her people that she hires to kind of shape the aesthetic and shape the vision of what she's doing. Which I think is really cool, you know, all the while, you know, because the bass is so powerful, ultimately, she's able to really make it her own, and it sounds like Missy's music, no matter what. Just that inherent collaborative environment that she creates has been a pretty big inspiration for me, because I feel like the guitar, in some ways, is similar within that string band context, where especially in a fiddle bass guitar trio, it's just really collaborative, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to harness the abilities and powers of the musicians that I've hired to really make the music, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it's joyful. It's really great.
So what strategies do you have for touring healthfully?
Well, that's a great question. So I don't have a booking agent, so I've been booking all the tours just completely on my own, which in a lot of ways has its benefits, because I can route the tour however I want to. You know, I can make decisions like, well, I don't want to drive more than 4 hours a day, so, you know, we'll book all these things pretty close together, and, you know, try to book accommodation close by, or, you know, try to find like a homestay somewhere. I feel like when you're not working with a booking agent, it depends on the booking agent, obviously, but generally you just have a lot more control over how the schedule goes and where you're going each day, and just, you know, how intense the traveling is ultimately. And so, yeah, I feel like I've just learned what actually goes into like a travel day and what kind of energy that takes. And then, you know, if you travel all day and then have to miraculously come up with another wave of energy to put on a 2-hour show, you know, I've learned what that's like, and I've learned how to work with that. So I would definitely say just like all that experience with Missy has definitely led to probably more sound decisions ultimately. But
And for the guitarists listening to this, they might be curious about your instruments, your favorite instruments, your collection.
Sure. So the main guitar that I play on with both Missy Raines and then for my own trio is a Huss and Dalton, like these two luthiers out of Stanton, Virginia, who make great instruments. And it's a 2013, like, traditional, or a TDM, I want to say. I'm forgetting like the exact model number, but it's like a traditional model, like, kind of like modeled after like old Martin vintage guitars. And I love that thing. I mean, it's in a way, like, I've grown into it. You know, like, I think just the longer you play a guitar, like, guitars, I mean, this is something that Julian Lodge says, is that your instrument can be your best teacher. You know, and I feel like that really ties into his whole, like, I don't know, this movement, you know, the Alexander Technique stuff, and just thinking about movement, thinking how you relate to your own body, but then also how you relate to your body in relation to your instrument, all that stuff. But in a lot of ways, yeah, I feel like that guitar has really been like a guiding light for me, and just how to how to project, you know, because guitar is... Often guitar is like the quietest instrument in a string band, or like in a bluegrass band. So the constant challenge, I suppose, is, you know, how do you get heard? You know, how do you project your sound in a way that isn't, you know, overdriving the instrument, or that isn't, you know, 'cause I feel like in some ways, if you play too hard, you actually end up kind of squashing the sound, or the sound's not as big as it can be. So finding that happy medium where you're getting, you know, as much resonance as possible, but also like funneling the sound the most direct way that you can. I feel like I've learned a lot about that with this guitar. And then another guitar that I have been traveling with for my own trio, I have it tuned down a whole step. And so it's just for one song on Kite's Keep. And that's a 00018 Martin guitar. Again, like newer, I think it's like a 2010 or something like that. Sounds good. It's not my personal favorite guitar, but it's I like it well enough. And the pickup system sounds really great. It has like a Fishman Aura. It's like a mic modeling pickup system, so it kind of like models the sound off like microphones and kind of get like a nice pickup sound or like a nicer pickup sound than like most like passive pick like an LR Bags pickup or something like that. So yeah, those are my two main guitars that I've been traveling with. But I guess I should also say for the record for Kite's Keep, I was able to borrow a couple really amazing instruments from Chris Eldridge. And the main guitar that we recorded with on Kite's Keep was a 1937, 1937 D18. Actually, the same guitar that he plays on that record Avalon with Julian. Actually, both records that he plays that he made with Julian, both Avalon and there's another record they made called Mount Royal. And so that's a very special instrument to me, and getting to play it on Kite's Keep was a real treat.
Yeah, I listened to a little bit of Mount Royal.
Oh, cool.
Track 7, A Place for the In-Between. You wrote it
Yes.
with Celia Hill, and you have a guitar duo album with her, and it features your friend, piano, well, it doesn't feature, but Matt Glassmeyer is playing on it. It's the one track. And you have a duo record with him.
Yes. So many duo records. Yeah. Celia and I went to college together. And she mostly wrote that song, or because we had like a kind of collaborative duo guitar project together. And she mostly wrote that song, and I kind of tweaked it, kind of like slightly rearranged it for this new album. And that was really fun to do that, because we were going to make another guitar record that kind of never happened, and that was going to be a song on it. So I decided to just, and I really liked it, so I kind of repurposed it for this record. And she was thrilled, like totally happy that happened. Yeah, and then Matt Glassmeyer, who and it's so funny because him playing piano on this song is like whatever, like 10% of like who he is as a musician. He's like just this totally amazing multi-instrumentalist. You know, does a lot of improvised music, but like has his own like solo project where he like writes songs and things like that. But he's also, I feel like he's just kind of like this, leader, like this linchpin of like Nashville creative people. You know, he hosts like a monthly concert series at his house, and everybody comes, and a couple people play, and then we just like talk about all kinds of things. You know, sometimes he gets like people from professors from Vanderbilt to like give a lecture about some interesting topic, or I don't know. He's able to like just bring a lot of really interesting, cool people together all in one place. And Matt and I's duo project, he primarily plays piano. It's like an acoustic piano, acoustic guitar duo, and that's entirely free music. You know, no, nothing written. We just get together and play, and then we record it. And so, as sort of a fun, I don't know if it's that fun, it's sort of a fun thing. I thought it'd be fun to give him like a fully composed, like pages of, a couple pages of sheet music to have him play on my album, because we had only been playing like free improvised music together. And it was a blast, and he killed it. Like, just like I feel like he like was so kind of in touch with the sentiment of that song. And just, I loved it. Just everything that he brought to that was just really beautiful.
Your titles are really poetic. I'm curious, do you write poetry at all?
I used to, I haven't in a long time, but I love poetry. It's like one of my favorite mediums, I guess, to create in. Yeah, but not in a while.
I wanted to ask you about teaching. You do quite a bit of teaching. So, is your approach different than the way you learned from people or?
Interesting. Probably not that different because I, you know, in some way that's like all I have to work with is to like how people taught me is like probably how I'll be teaching other people. But I also come from a family of teachers. Like both my parents are academics, and you know, my dad is still teaching. My mom retired a couple of years ago, and you know, so I feel like in some ways it's probably just a part of me. But then I've also just had so many great teachers over the years. You know, I've talked about Critter and then Julian and that University of North Texas, you know, just like the whole slew of guitar professors that were there. And then other like non-guitar, just like people in the jazz faculty, just incredible, like some of the best teachers in the world, really. And then Andy Timmons, you know, when I was really young, and even still to this day, he's just been a really important mentor. So yeah, I don't know. I feel like I've had a lot of just really great models for, yeah, ideas in music and how to, without like banging your head against the, like if you run into a problem as a practicing musician, you know, instead of just banging your head against the wall and hoping that something works, you know, finding creative ways to sort of get around the wall, you know. That's something that I particularly I feel like Julian and Chris Eldridge are just so masterful at. They have all these like really just creative ways of thinking about things and just approaching music and guitar playing that, yeah, just it just leads to a much more fulfilled and sustainable and joyful life as a musician. And I'm just grateful to be around that.
That's beautiful. So I wanted to talk about the final track. First of all, Somewhere Near Hope, another beautiful title. You
Thanks.
use field recordings. We feel like we're around a campfire. And the final, if I remember correctly, the final chord doesn't resolve harmonically. Like you kind of leave the album with a question.
In some ways, I want to like write a blues, which I know the song sounds nothing like a blues. Although I feel like because it has or the basic form of it exists in kind of these 12-bar structures. You have like a first 12 bars, and then you have a second 12 bars. So in a way, like I think what's so cool about like just the traditional blues form is that it actually never really resolves. It kind of has this like looping around itself quality to it. And so I want to, yeah, I wanted to write a tune with that conceit, I suppose. You know, something that never really climaxed, but that just keeps wanting you to listen to it again and again. Yeah, and then Somewhere Near Hope kind of just fell out. Very few pieces of music, I feel like, effectively do that. You know, where it just kind of has this like loop, not looping quality, but just the wrapping around itself kind of thing. I feel like that was, yeah, that's sort of like the main guiding force. And then, yeah, just having something kind of meditative, and I feel like the field recordings sort of evoked something in that. And the melody too just has so much space, you know. And I feel like that invited a lot of different ways to present the music, whether it's field recordings or just people doing different things in the spaces, the musicians in the band kind of filling out the spaces in different ways, and yeah.
It's a really beautiful album. You know, I listen to a lot of music, and there's a couple times I literally listen to the whole thing right through, like a concert. It's really great.
Thank you, Leia. Thank you. It's very sweet.
I'm guessing you guys recorded more than you could fit on the album.
There was one song that I decided to cut last minute, but no, mostly it was like pretty calculated, you know. We or like I had like kind of the all the songs in it's they're Basically their final form arrangement wise before we got into the studio, because like I said, you know, I'd worked with like Daryl on the songs that he played on, and then I had also been playing the songs live quite a bit with sometimes Brittany and Ethan Yojevitz, and then sometimes other trios. But yeah, so it was, unlike my first record, this was, I feel like it was a lot more, I don't know, I guess like intentional, or just like there's a lot more ideas behind before coming into the studio.
And in terms of upcoming projects, do you have anything you want to talk about?
Yeah, third record is definitely underway. I am kind of in the middle of writing a lot of that music still at the moment, but hopefully something will emerge next year with that. I have my second leg of my album release tour coming up, and that'll start in November. And that's entirely in the Northeast. That'll be really fun. That's going to be with Brittany Haas and Dan Klingsberg on bass. And Dan and I have never really played together before, but I've, you know, I've heard him on a lot of records, and we have tons of mutual friends, and he just seems like a really awesome, sweet, lovely guy, and a great musician. So I'm excited.
Well, so great to meet you. So thanks a lot.
Thanks, Leia. Such a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leiaroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support this series, that would be wonderful. I'm an independent podcaster and I really do need the help of my listeners. Keep in mind, I've also linked directly several episodes you'll find interesting in the show notes of this one. All the links are in the show notes. The podcast theme music was written by Nick Cold. Have a wonderful week.